Hey everyone, and welcome to another edition of Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. We've got a great show for you this week. I'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about all of the week's security news. We're also going to take a look at some of the things that President-elect Donald Trump has promised to do. And we're also going to hear from Chris Tarbell, who is a former FBI agent and the man who actually put handcuffs on Ross Ulbricht in that library over a decade ago. And he's joining us to fill us in on some of the details about the Ross Ulbricht Silk Road case that people seem to have forgotten. This week's sponsor interview is with Feroz Abukadije of Socket. You can find them at socket.dev. And what Socket does is to basically ensure that you're not including dangerous packages in your software projects, right? So it's like a supply chain security product. I'm about to publish a demo of that one to our YouTube channel in a couple of days. You'll be able to check that out. And this week, Feroz is talking to us. He's joining us to make the case that we should look at trojaned packages. We should look at tracking them in the same way that we track CVEs. So someone like NIST needs to actually track these things, have timelines, have an index, much the same way we track CVEs. It's actually a pretty compelling case. That interview is coming up later. But Adam, we're going to start off this week by talking about the news that iOS 18.1 has a new feature. And that new feature is that if you don't unlock your phone in a 72-hour period, it reboots. And what that means is it winds up in a state which is called BFU, or before first unlock, which makes it much more difficult to crack. So this is something that law enforcement has discovered recently, and they are not happy about it, at least according to reporting from Joe Cox over at 404 Media.
Yeah, when the police seize people's iPhones, if they don't immediately have access to unlock them, they will typically plug them in, stick them in a Faraday bag, and put them on a shelf. That's A, so like the process can kind of work through. They might get access to the passphrases through, you know, some other means from the people who originally owned the phones. But they've been discovering that, yes, those devices have been rebooting themselves, which makes it a whole bunch more complicated. And, you know, Apple's relationship with law enforcement has been pretty complicated, you know, over the last few years. You know, they've been unwilling to provide unlock assistance for phones. And law enforcement has kind of settled into a middle ground where they can use exploit techniques, hacker techniques, to bypass them, or they can kind of wait for, you know, over time as unlocks become available with, older versions of the software, you know, to be able to unlock them later on. And that, you know, Apple has, I mean, that relationship has been complicated, I think. Mm. And you and I have talked several times about kind of like where that game ends for Apple and law enforcement, because it's, you know, it's a difficult situation for both sides.
It is. I mean, I think that the interesting thing here is that there was a bit of a status quo when it came to unlocking seized devices, which, you know, as you say, stick them in a locker somewhere, wait for an unlock against that version of the software to become available down the line, and then use that unlock capability against those phones. That was the status quo. This changes that. And I can see Apple's point of view, which is that they are a privacy-first company. They also have customers who might be located in places that aren't really down with due process, right? So protecting users against, authoritarian states and whatnot seems like a pretty good idea. Although I think this disproportionately impacts places that do have due process, because in the places that don't have due process, when they discover that they can't unlock these devices, they're just more likely to pull someone out of a cell and beat the crap out of them until they get the passphrases. Whereas, the FBI, at least at the moment, can't do that. So I do feel that perhaps this is going to disproportionately impact, law enforcement in democratic countries. And I don't think that's great.
Yeah, and this sort of resolving this tension between, privacy and security and law enforcement oversight and, the ability of the government to try and make communities safe, right? This is a tension we've seen play out in so many parts of the tech industry as, we've got to the point where it is legitimately difficult to intercept communications, to unlock devices, and, you know, the traditional tools of wiretaps and pen registers and whatever else, you know, have been gradually chipped away. And, you know, we haven't really figured out how to resolve that tension. I mean, the, you know, the traditional sort of cypherpunk approach of, you know, if there's an intercept mechanism or an observation mechanism that can be abused by third parties is a risk that means we should have end-to-end crypto or whatever else. Like, you know, we've seen intrusions into lawful intercept systems in telcos, you know, that we're talking about in the news at the moment. So, you know, that tension is playing up in a bunch of places, and this is just kind of one. And Apple's maneuvering to kind of position themselves as a privacy first company, as a, you know, as a, because their competitors in the marketplace are, you know, more advertising centric, don't make quite so much money out of devices, right? They, you know, it's in their interests to be seen that way, and also to kind of follow through, right? Not just talk, they have to, you know, deliver code and devices that live up to that. So it's a, you know, a tough set of trade-offs for them and for law enforcement.
Yeah, well, I think this is really going to annoy law enforcement, particularly in the United States, given that's where Apple's from, right? So I think that's gonna really drive them a bit nuts. But you're right, we are talking about intrusions into surveillance systems. And we got an interesting story here from the Wall Street Journal, where a U.S. agency, it's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has warned its staff not to use cell phones. Don't use plain old cell phone calls and text messages to conduct agency business. You got to do that stuff on Microsoft Teams. And I think this is a really interesting development. Now, obviously, they say this is because telcos are a little bit insecure upstream. You know, I don't think they explicitly say it's because of this campaign, but that's, you know, kind of implied in the advice they're giving to staff here. What I find interesting about this, though, is that Teams, as best I know, is not end-to-end encrypted. That material can be obtained, you know, an intruder into Microsoft would be able to get that material. So I think what's interesting here is they're saying, don't trust the telcos, but you can trust Microsoft, right? Which kind of shows us that telcos do have a problem when it comes to being able to secure their networks. You know, it really does. They really do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've long said that, you know, telcos are the natural enemy of my people being hackers. Like, it's where we all learned our trade. You know, it's breaking into the telco, stealing phone company manuals and lineman handsets. Like, that's just what hackers did in the old days. And so, you know, they're huge, complicated environments, and they're very, very difficult to secure. But, you know, in some respects, like, you look at Teams, if anything, Teams is more friendly to be able to, you know, steal content. I mean, like, it will automatically transcribe, you know, to text meetings and calls that you have, and then store them and restore video recordings of meetings and all those sorts of things. Like, there is a lot in Teams to help yourself to, which is, you know, better, like, less well protected than, you know, lawful intercept in a telco in many cases, despite the fact that the telcos are also trash. So, I mean, it's definitely, it's a bold move to say use Teams instead of the phone, but you're right, telcos have a long and rather poor security history, and, you know, Microsoft also not doing super great, but hopefully better. Yeah. Hopefully better than the average telco.
There's also the rumor going around that the Salt Typhoon intrusion, and hopefully we find out from the CSRB investigation, but there's also a rumor floating around that most of that activity took place on networking equipment, right? Which is why maybe they didn't see it via their EDR. I can't wait to get that CSRB report into Salt Typhoon.
It's going to be a good one. I'm super looking forward to that, because I do love telco gubbins. So yeah, I'm very much here for that. Good luck, CSRB board. We are ready with bated breath for your report.
Now, let's talk about some data that's come out of CISA, which has resulted in a, you know, Five Eyes Alliance kind of, you know, warning about it. There's been an interesting move in stats around the types of vulnerabilities that are popping up being used in the wild. In previous years, up to last year, it was quite often like end-day bugs that were being most commonly used to attack targets and pop shells and whatever. That changed last year. Two-thirds, or 10 out of the 15 most frequently exploited vulnerabilities last year were O-Day. So this is new, and it was all enterprise software tech. And it also represented a huge swing towards edge devices. And this is stuff that we've talked about, you know, so much over the last couple of years, which is these like VPNs and, you know, file transfer appliances, things like that at the edge of your network. It's good to see some hard data here that is pretty difficult to refute. You know what I mean? Like you look at this and you're just like, okay, well, this is definitely a thing now. What's your take on all of this?
Yeah, I agree. It's nice to have data that lines up with our experience, you know, what we've been reporting on, you know, over the last little while, you know, is that pivot was happening. And it's nice to see data that supports that. And, you know, there's long past time for the vendors of edge equipment to take that stuff kind of seriously. And it's an interesting, like, the landscape for network edge devices compared to, you know, like how many years ago, 10 years ago now, when we pivoted from server-side exploitation to client-side, you know, ActiveX control bugs and Acrobat PDF reader bugs and Flash bugs, you know, that set of software that always had those problems, Acrobat and Flash, seemed kind of more fixable in a way that fixing Fortinet and Cisco and Citrix do now. Although I guess it didn't feel that way at the time, so maybe
That's why Adobe couldn't wait to kill Flash. You know, they didn't really
didn't want to kill it.
Security leadership at Adobe did not sign up for having the most, you know, widely used, complicated client software on the planet. You know, that's not really what they wanted out of the Macromedia acquisition. But that's just sort of that's just sort of how it turned out. But you're right. I mean, that's the case of one vendor having to fix something versus, in this case, a whole bunch of others with, you know, all of their own approaches to development and whatever. But I will say, too, that you were having a good old chuckle about Fortinet, you know, committing to secure code, the secure code initiative in our Slack the other day. And I'm like, what, you're laughing at them for trying? That seems a little bit uncharitable.
I mean, you know, if it was a good faith effort, but I just kind of feel like Fortinet is you know, and this is modular, us both knowing plenty of good people that work at Fortinet. Like the time for a good faith effort was, you know, not now, it was several years ago when they saw this coming. And, you know, I'm a little salty about, you know, how much marketing dollar they spend versus how much they should probably spend on product QA. But yeah,
well, I mean, they should have seen this coming, I think is the point, right? Yes. Like they should have seen this coming many, many years ago.
Yeah, agree. And I mean, and when you've seen the insides of some of those products, right, they had plenty of opportunity to do some of this stuff, right? Because some of these bugs are, you know, really brain dead, you know, stuff that even a basic code review, basic pen test of the product before you shipped it would have picked up, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I've been burnt by many Fortinet products, so I have feelings.
You do. Now let's talk about some incident response research out of Russia. And we are looking at Goblin Rat, which is what looks to be a pretty sweet bit of Linux malware that is popping up in all sorts of interesting places in Russia. Your money is on this being Western SIGINT. Walk us through the research here, the teardown of this backdoor, and also the, you know, build the case for us as to why you think this is, you know, probably some friends of ours.
So yeah, this is some malware that was discovered inside some Linux boxes in critical infrastructure services. We don't know exactly where. Russian companies written it up and done some conference presentations about it as well. We're going off machine translation, so there's always some room for error there, but this is a piece of, you know, Linux malware that provides the usual sorts of things, you know, like remote access, you know, files copying up and down, shells, network pivoting, that kind of thing. But it has a number of kind of relatively stealthy, relatively sophisticated features. So one is, you know, obviously kind of process hiding stuff. Two is command and control is done with like port knocking, configurable port knocking. It's written in Go, so it's nice and portable. And it has you know, a whole bunch of stealth mechanisms that just feel like things that SIGINTers would do. So for example, it'll drop binaries into DevSHM, which is like a RAM disk, so you don't leave traces on disk. It will overwrite when it gets told to delete itself off disk. It will overwrite with, you know, data from the random device to, you know, defeat disk forensics and a whole bunch of kind of, you know, long-term persistent stealthiness. It runs in the bits that do, like, do the initial persistence, hide themselves as various, you know, like a typo of a system process, like one letter different from a system process, and that's different on every box. And then the C2 endpoints are also different on every box, using domains that are only used for that purpose. There's strong crypto everywhere, like cert auth on all the bits, and, you know, it just feels well engineered. And then the people who did forensics on this actually pulled memory images from a bunch of systems to try and, you know, identify infections of this stuff, and found a few fragments in like unallocated memory that kind of showed some of the usage patterns, and it feels human driven, right? There is someone hands on keyboard making choices, choosing what to do on a particular box, that, you know, there's a degree of skill involved in that. And that's a thing that, you know, to do at scale, you have to be a SIGINT agent. So you have to be someone that's got the people who are sufficiently skilled to do this, not just off a playbook.
Yeah. So this is less Vault Typhoon and more maybe Eagle Tornado, if we had to guess, yeah. Or perhaps T-Fog. Just trying to come up with these names on the spot so you can catch my drift. But it does kind of feel like that, doesn't it?
I think Pink Apple may well be what it's called, because one of the domain names used that particular name in a few bits when they went back and looked at some like passive DNS history and so on. Anyway, it feels like the Russian in question who stumbled across this thing when they were investigating something for a client, I feel has probably stumbled across them.
I fear I was too subtle, because what is more American than an Eagle Tornado? And what is more British than tea and fog? Anyway,
yes, we may well be friends of ours, so good work if it was, because, like, yeah, it's look pretty reasonable code.
Yeah, we've linked through to the original write-up, which is in Russian, but Translate actually worked pretty well on it, so people can check that out if they are interested in it. Now we're going to talk about some, you know, two bits of really interesting research here. Talk to us about this Microsoft bookings one where, like, email aliases get created. Like, this whole thing is a bit of a head scratcher. We'll start with this Cyberis research into a Microsoft bug, a cloud services bug. Talk us through it.
In Microsoft Azure land, you can arrange bookings for meetings and things, and you can invite other people to meetings and so on and so forth. One of the features is when you create a booking for a meeting, it will create a mailbox to receive messages. So you can kind of create, you know, repositories for, you know, to collect attendance information or whatever else. And so these email accounts will get created kind of programmatically based on the name of the meeting. And they get, like, allocated a non-build, like, secret Microsoft 365 mailbox that still functions as a real mailbox, but doesn't charge you a license. So that's nice if you want to get some free Microsoft mailboxes. But you can use this as a low privileged attacker to create mailboxes under domain. And there's a number of places where that might be useful. You could create mailboxes that impersonate other people. So there's some limits as to what characters you can have, but you could make mailboxes that look like legitimate people. You could make mailboxes to bypass things that do domain control authentication via email. So, like, buy certificates, for example. Or you can reactivate old employee accounts if the accounts that it makes are in the kind of the style of the normal, you know, email format for that organization. So it's a really interesting tool to go from low priv to I can create new email accounts and then I can use that for social engineering or technical attacks or whatever else. And this is probably a surprise to many organizations because, hey, the cloud future, we have no idea what crazy stuff Microsoft is doing, and this seems a little on the crazy side. So, yeah. Very useful for me.
Yeah, but it's also one of those weird edge case kind of bugs that you wouldn't necessarily think to look for in a standard audit. That's why I find it interesting, right? Because some of these, like, business logic bugs are always the best. because they are subtle and they are hard to find. And, you know, they give some examples of the types of email mailboxes you could sort of register here. And it's like administrator at domain, hostmaster, postmaster, webmaster, admin, root, you know, those are going to come in handy, right? So I just thought that was a, you know, really interesting bit of research. We've also got some research out of TrustedSec from Justin Bollinger here, which is amazing, actually, involving dodgy, like, certificate signing requests. Talk to us about this one.
Yeah, so this is some research that built on, like, the classic 80 certificate services attacks that came out of, like, Spectre Ops crew a few years back. And this is a variant of one of those where, essentially, you can land on a box as a user and then get a certificate issued where you control some of the contents and using like the normal kind of templates for certificate requests that Windows has. And this was a trick, I guess, where you could change the purpose of the certificate that was being issued. In this case, you could change the subject of the certificate that was being issued in ways that are surprising. And the guts of this is that it turns out there's kind of two ways to specify the specifics of the certificate that you're getting issued. There's a Microsoft way and there's a standard way. And it turns out that if you specify both, it prefers the Microsoft way and then will issue you a certificate where you can, like, you know, get a certificate, a user certificate for administrator and then onwards to for domain admin and onwards to great victory. This, you know, was a, it's the sort of nuance that lurks in ADCS that traps all sorts of people. The researchers at TrustedSec who found this ended up looking at a number of their customers and found that this was applicable there. Microsoft were a little confused about the bug report, about whether it was kind of like intended behavior or not, but it clearly is not good. And given there's already, 15 ways or something like that to get privileged access to escalate your access through AD certificate services, like, yet another one is not good, because these are real workhorse bugs for people escalating access in Windows environments.
Yep, they are, right? And it's a fun write-up, and we've linked through to that one. Yes. in the show notes. Moving on, and Darina Antoniuk over at The Record has a report on Russia doing something that China already did, I think, a year or two ago, which is to block Cloudflare encrypted client hello. So essentially ECH, what did it used to be called? It used to be called
ESNI was the ESNI,
encrypted server name indication. Right. Yeah. So it used to be ESNI, and now in TLS 1.3, it is ECH. And what that essentially is like domain fronting by design. It gives you what domain fronting would give you, in that you could just connect to a CDN and then in your client hello specify where you want to go, and then you connect there, right? But that's all encrypted and it's not observable. So this ECH can really be used to bypass censorship, which is one thing that's very useful about it, and why China and Russia are blocking it. Now, the reason I've been banging on about ESNI and ECH for years is that it's also a really, really cool way to do C2 in a way that is very, very difficult to detect, because you're just going to see packets going out to Cloudflare. So that's something that I think people need to think about when they're architecting like network detection. This is also a solid argument for doing more instrumentation of browsers so that you can actually know where the browsers are going. And then, like, if that data doesn't match with other data that is going off to Cloudflare CDN with a, you know, domain name that you have no idea about because it's encrypted in the client hello. It's interesting. So Russia and China have blocked it for censorship reasons, but this stuff is going to be a problem eventually. I think the one mitigation here is that when you are pushing your C2 through a CDN, you are vulnerable at that point to the CDN squashing your campaign. But if you're writing decent enough malware, you can build a bit of redundancy in there. Frankly, I'm surprised we don't see this sort of C2 being widespread. But everyone I ask about that just says, well, people don't need to do that yet, because it's not like they can't get functioning C2 just with basic techniques. But I guess the long story short is I think encrypted client hello is the future of malware C2. I'm not surprised to see Russia join China and ban this when they're starting to get more restrictive about what people can see on the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Cloudflare has done quite a bit of the engineering work and also deployed this by default in their environment, which I think has probably pushed Russia's hand a little bit. You know, I think China was kind of slightly ahead of the game, but Russia is now seeing it being a practical problem for them, which I think was the point, right? That's why Cloudflare did it. But yeah, I agree with you that, you know, like domain fronting was so useful back in, you know, before we had to worry so much about how we were going to get detected. And this, as you say, does the same things that domain fronting kind of delivered for us in a way that's even harder to observe without being in the browser, without being in the network stack.
Well, yeah, and without having some sort of logic to like compare different data sources, like it's a pain in the you know what to try to get around, like to try to detect this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And with like the main challenge with ESNI was it relied heavily on DNS to get the keys to send the encrypted SNI. And if you just blocked the DNS, that particular part of the DNS request, it would kind of fall back so you could see it. Whereas ECH is kind of designed so that with an attacker observing the DNS and able to control it, you've got kind of more options for getting the right key material out to the client. Like it can send new key material like midway through the TLS handshake so that the client can then send the encrypted client hello encrypted correctly without having to trust the DNS, which that combined with DNS over HTTPS, which again Cloudflare did a lot of the work on, like all these pieces kind of joined together to make it pretty technically difficult to do anything other than just straight up block this.
Yeah. So just one to keep an eye on, I reckon, is just how that all progresses, right? Because I think eventually, enterprises, maybe other networks are just going to say, you know, we're seeing so much abuse with some of this, you know, via ECH through some of these CDNs, we might need to block them. I doubt they're going to block Cloudflare. That's Cloudflare's thing, though. They're so big that you can't block them, and it's just going to cause headaches. But Cloudflare certainly used to doing that. It looks like Tor has published a write-up on how they've managed to mitigate the IP spoofing attack that was targeting their relays. So I think we spoke about this on the show. I can't remember if we actually spoke about this on the show or if it was just in Risky Business News, our other podcast. But the idea here was people were spoofing SSH scanning activity from Tor relay IPs, right? So they'd find the IPs for Tor relays, they would spoof SSH connections, which would result in abuse complaints being directed to the ISPs where those relays were located. So this is like what we used to call a Joe job when it came to you know, email, like spamming from an address that you didn't like to get that address sort of blackholed. Similar sort of thing here, but with SSH scanning. And it looks like, though, that Tor has been able to sort this out. How did they go about sorting out something like this? Because I would have thought that would be pretty difficult.
I think there's kind of two aspects to it. There's one, like whoever was spoofing the traffic, I guess they figured out where it was coming from and managed to shut that down. And the specifics of how they did that is a little vague. They did say that it was done in cooperation with old man Andrew from Greynoise. So that might give you some idea of kind of what was involved. The other half was there was an organization that was sending abuse complaints kind of, you know, in an automated willy-nilly kind of fashion that was amplifying the effectiveness of the spoofed packets. So I think they managed to get a bunch of people to ignore that particular organization that was just generating, the organization said like billions of abuse complaints or something. So like, I don't know what the hell they were doing, but so I think that was the two-pronged approach that they took. But they have been a little bit cagey about the specifics from, you know, what they did with the spoofing origin.
Yeah. Now, speaking of bad stuff being kicked off the internet, talk to us about this operation that Dan Gooden has reported on that has resulted in something like 22,000 malicious IPs being taken down. How does one take down an IP, Adam?
Well, that bit's a little bit unclear. This report's been quite interesting. It's an operation, I think, led by Interpol called Synergia 2. And it took down, you know, a whole bunch of malicious servers, associated address space, and some other bits and pieces. But most of the targets of this operation appear to actually be in China. The reporting says that there are like 1,000 servers taken down in Hong Kong. another couple of hundred, 300 in Macau, and then a few other bits and pieces in Mongolia and Madagascar and Estonia. So kind of a worldwide, you know, police operation, law enforcement operation, but, you know, the bulk of it inside China. And I haven't seen any specifics about exactly kind of like what sorts of cybercrime they were doing, and the number of like 30,000 potentially malicious IP addresses have been bandied about in the press release. And I'm not quite clear, you know, what they were doing with them. But either way, wrapping up 1,000 boxes, I think in Madagascar, they seized like what? Like they arrested, I think, 11 people. So like it's a pretty reasonable sized operation. 93 in Mongolia, 93 people. So like quite a big police thing, but not a whole bunch of details about what the cyber crimes in question actually were.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, the three private organizations that participated in this were Group IB, which are based in Singapore these days, but were originally Russian, Kaspersky, and Team Kumri. So an interesting little mix there.
Yeah, interesting get-together there.
Exactly. It is time for us to have a little bit of a chat about last week's election. Donald Trump has been returned to the White House, and he'll be inaugurated next year. I do recall some months ago saying on the show when we were talking about the possibility of Trump coming back, you expressed some skepticism. And having traveled to the US a couple of times in the last year, I think I said, well, you know, I wouldn't rule it out because voters were really waiting for Joe Biden with baseball bats. So I'm not terribly shocked that Trump has been returned to the White House, but this will have implications for the intelligence community, for tech policy, for cybersecurity. The TikTok ban that was going to kick in a couple of months, I don't think that's happening anymore. Trump has, it was his idea, and then he changed his mind. So it looks like TikTok will remain a going concern in the United States. The forced divestiture, I don't think that's going to happen. There's one other thing that Trump promised to do in the lead up to the election, which is very controversial, which is he's agreed, well, he has pledged to release Ross Ulbricht from prison. So Ross Ulbricht was the founder and administrator for the Silk Road, which was the first really big illicit online marketplace. You could buy heroin there, you could buy body parts, you could buy euthanasia drugs. And Ulbricht was also alleged to have organized something like 6 murders for hire. And somehow over the last decade, people seem to have forgotten a lot of the particulars of the case. This morning I interviewed the guy who actually put the handcuffs on Ross Ulbricht, who is a now former FBI agent named Chris Tarbell. And we're going to play that interview in just a moment. But before we do, Adam, what do you make of this political support that Ross Ulbricht has received over the last few years? Because I agree that his sentence actually might, you could argue that his sentence is excessive, but I don't see why there's so much political pressure to get him out after spending only a decade in prison, given he was a drug kingpin who, you know, a convicted drug kingpin who put out hits on people, you know. But what's your take on this?
Yeah, I guess the comparison with, say, Assange is the one that is the most obvious, right? Where there has been a long undercurrent of support for Assange that you can kind of understand why, right? You can see the lines for that. Whereas with DPR, Dread Pirate Roberts / Ross Ulbricht, it was never quite so clear. I mean, people would have made the argument about, you know, Silk Road was in some respects a safer place to buy drugs than, you know, your local streets. But as in the interview that you're going to play in a second, you make the point that, you know, it made it a lot easier to get drugs full stop, which overall increased the harm because more people had access to harder drugs. And I think that there's sort of a, you know, the long war on drugs that America has, you know, has fought, I think, you know, there's a degree of sort of, I was going to say like, nostalgia is not the right word, but there's a degree of sympathy for the extent to which anti-drug policies have not helped, and that maybe legalizing or reducing penalties or whatever else might actually be a better option. And
well, we've seen that. You walk through the streets of Washington, D.C. now, and it's reeks of weed, you know, like we've seen decriminalization in a bunch of states, right? I agree that a war on drug users is ridiculous. On people who are selling small quantities of drugs to support their own habits, those people don't belong in prison, right? Like, I 100% agree with that. And I think we've got to differentiate between people like that getting into trouble and drug kingpins who order murders at the drop of a hat to protect their multi-million dollar profits, which is what Ross Ulbricht was. You know, so this is the thing where I start to get a little bit,
I think those two things do get kind of smushed together in people's heads, right?
Yeah.
Because it's easy for some people to look at someone like Ulbricht and say, this guy is, you know, progressive and, you know, is kind of on our side if you're into harm minimization overall. And as you say, he is not, right? He, you know, people will hear the list of the interview in a second, but, you know, he really isn't. And I think it is good to remind people some of the specifics of that case, because it does seem kind of hard to support letting him out, even if, you know, two lifetimes seems like quite a long sentence for someone. But yeah, I think it's timely.
I mean, I think the guy has reasonable prospects at rehabilitation, right? I don't think he should die in prison, but I also think 11 years for what he did. And, you know, just on the drugs accessibility thing, I know that if you take a heroin user and drop them onto the surface of Mars, they will be able to find heroin. Okay.
it's quite a hell of a motivator, right?
It is. They will find it, right? So I'm not arguing that there's this huge accessibility problem with drugs for drug users. But I think in the case of Silk Road, there were documented instances of people who did not otherwise have access to drugs accessing, you know, very dangerous substances via Silk Road simply because they could. Because they drop into a chat and people were talking about these drugs. I'll just add to cart, right? And that's dangerous. That's really dangerous. So I think, they definitely needed to send a message, but the idea that a pro law and order candidate, you know, is or president is going to commute the sentence of someone who committed these crimes just seems absolutely insane to me. So Adam, let's you and I wrap it up and then I'll play that interview, but thank you as always for this week's news discussion. Always great, and I'll chat to you next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. I will talk to you then.
So that was Adam Boileau there with a wrap of the week's news. And here, as promised, is my interview with Chris Tarbell. Now, Chris was the FBI agent who led one of the investigations into Silk Road. He was actually the agent who put the cuffs on Ross Ulbricht in that library back in, I think, 2013. And he joined me for this conversation about the proposed release of Dread Pirate Roberts, aka Ross Ulbricht. Now, it's important to note that Chris is not advocating that Ross Ulbricht should stay in prison, but he does want to make sure people remember the facts of the case as he remembers them. So here's Chris Tarbell.
My big problem is that there are a lot of misstatements or misunderstandings exactly of what's going on in this case. And you use the word allegations, and that's correct. There is some allegations. Ross was found guilty of numerous crimes, including, you know, kingpin status, and that's really what carried the heavy weight, two counts of it. And that's selling a large number of drugs, profiting over a certain amount, and having a certain number of employees under your employment was that one. But there were also, there's allegations, and again, he was never found guilty or charged with these crimes. There were six murders for hire, six people where he paid, ordered and paid to have them killed because they had stolen money from him. There were numerous deaths on the site that he took no responsibility for. And in fact, he, you know, sort of let the operation continue on, even though he knew people were dying from the drugs taken from his site. So I just want to make sure the facts are out there and the people making the right decisions are in the facts. The people that are advocating for his release or his stay in prison know the facts of what's really happened in this case.
All right. So let's start off with the overdoses, right? Because DOJ were able to pin down or attribute six fatal overdoses to the site. And I'm guessing there were a lot more. Advocates for what Ross Ulbricht was doing with Silk Road said that this was a safer way for drug users to acquire drugs. And therefore, you know, if you believe in harm minimization, that, you know, Silk Road was a net positive. The counter argument to that, though, is that it made hard drugs accessible to people who otherwise would not be able to obtain them. And indeed, in some of these overdose cases that where we saw letters from the parents, it certainly looks like these people were getting access to drugs that they otherwise probably wouldn't have. I'm wondering what your feeling is on that part of this discussion.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't just weed and mushrooms and what people would call lighter drugs. It was high-grade Afghan heroin. You could get really quality stuff that wasn't stepped on. And when I say quality stuff, I mean, from a drug user, it's very high potency. But kids died from it because they didn't realize what was in it. The advocates will say it was safer because the kids didn't have to go into the streets and deal with someone where they could be shot or in a dangerous part of town. I don't buy that argument. That doesn't seem to hold water with me. We were given access to drugs that were used for for people ending their lives at the end of their life if they wanted to. In some countries that's legal, but kids underage, there were no ID checks. There was nothing to what these drugs were being used for. So the site just gave access to people to drugs that they wouldn't be able to get access to normally. I don't say it's safer. They had much more access to much more powerful drugs.
Yeah. I mean, I think the argument there, though, is that, it would be a change to the criminal ecosystem, which would make the process of buying drugs safer. But I think some of these people who are buying hard drugs on Silk Road perhaps wouldn't be as motivated to go into, a dangerous neighborhood where there are corner dealers, right? to go and buy heroin otherwise. I mean, that's my opinion on that.
Sure. But I mean, what about the postage handlers, the people handling the drugs, or what if the package breaks? We can play the what if game all day. They're putting those people at risk. Those people didn't decide to handle hard narcotics or some sort of fentanyl that got on their skin and have an attack. You're putting those people at risk because you didn't want to, go get your drug somewhere. We could do the counter argument to each one of these.
I understand where you're coming from, but there are no documented cases, as far as I'm aware of that having happened. Not that I'm at all defending Silk Road or Ross Ulbricht. Now let's talk about the murders for hire, right? Because you said there were six murders for hire. Now, what we do know about these murders for hire is that in all cases, I believe, Ross Ulbricht was actually getting scammed by people who were claiming to be assassins. So he paid the money, and in some cases, murders were staged so that there were death photos sent back to him, and he's like, good, this person is dead, I paid for it, here is your money. But no one actually died, did they, in these murder for hire plots?
Correct. The six we discovered, and again, the evidence of these crimes, these murder for hires, came directly either from the logs that Ross Ulbricht kept on his computer systems, or his diary that he kept on his computer system. That was the evidence of these. So once we investigated them, yes, we figured out that it most likely was a scam, based on time frames and locations. We never found, reported bodies or the found bodies. These were all in foreign countries, except for the two in the United States that was done through law enforcement, through the Baltimore task force. Yes, you are correct. No bodies were found. But again, he ordered them, he paid for them, and then he bragged about them afterwards.
Yeah. Now, a couple of these, was it one or two, were actually stage managed by law enforcement. So the apparent assassin was actually law enforcement saying, yeah, I'll take the job, and then staging the photos and whatnot. Was that one or two of them, or was that all of them, or?
That was just one. That was a former admin on the site, someone who helped run the site before Ross, had stole cryptocurrency from him. And so in a ploy to try to get that money back, law enforcement staged the murder.
So that was just one out of the six, right? Because I think there's a perception out there that all of these murders for hire, there was like law enforcement were somehow involved in these. And that's not the case.
No, the other five were not. They was just being tricked by someone, kind of egging him on to do this. And to kind of get into his bona fides, try to get, lift him up and say that hey, we should do this and get this done. Again, it turned out to be a scam. But at one point, the murder for hire, told Ross, hey, I can't get to this guy. He's got three other roommates. We were not able to get to him without, doing other things. And Ross was just said, kill them all. So yeah, he was willing to kill everyone in the house. And again, this comes from the logs that he collected on his own conversations that we were able to get a copy of.
Now, why were these crimes? They were mentioned in charging documents, I believe, initially, not the final criminal complaint. but they were mentioned at some point along by DOJ. Why were these crimes never charged? Because that is one of the things that Ross Ulbricht's supporters say, which is, oh, they talk about these murder for hire, but if it was real, they would have charged it. You know, is it the case that, you know, DOJ just had such a solid case on the drug stuff that they didn't want to complicate proceedings? Like, can you explain to the listeners why it is that Ross Ulbricht was never charged with murder for hire?
Sure. So the decision was made at a much higher level than me. Very high in the DOJ was that. But, you know, he was sentenced to, again, two life sentences plus 40 years in the federal system in the United States. Life means life. The only way you can get out is if the Supreme Court, rules and all those options have gone for against Ross, or if a president lets you out, commute your sentence. Again, it would have been just piling on top to keep going that. And the law enforcement murder for hire with the agents that were involved was out of Baltimore. That case sort of fell apart because those agents were later arrested for committing crimes in this case. And so, again, that muddies the water. Why have a case against someone who's already serving two life sentences plus 40 years in a case where, you know, there were bad agents involved?
Yeah, so for those who are unfamiliar, those agents were actually caught stealing Bitcoin as part of this operation, right?
They stole the Bitcoin that Ross wanted back for the first murder, for the admin that was killed, supposedly killed. They ended up taking the cryptocurrency.
So, I mean, that would have been the obvious one to charge, right? Because you had law enforcement observing blow by blow this murder plot. But as you say, this was complicated by the fact that those agents committed crimes during the course of this investigation.
Correct. And again, I'm not totally intimate with all the details, but I am remembering that their crimes were committed after Ross had ordered the murder. So, but it's still, yeah. Again, all the facts would have come out in trial, and it just would have made the case much more difficult.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what about the other murders for hire? Is it the case that just trying to prosecute those crimes based on chat logs would have been a heavy lift? Because I'm guessing that would have been a big part of it for prosecutors.
So, I'm not a lawyer, so I wouldn't want to argue that. So I presented my facts to the Southern District and they decided what we were charging. The case we had was solid, and you see the results from the 3-hour jury verdict to the judge's sentencing. It would have been further complicated the case to add more charges to it that obviously were attempts for murder for hire.
So why is it that you think, given that we know this is a person who, you know, allegedly committed, there is evidence that they committed murders for hire or at least solicited murders, cold-blooded murders in one case involving an entire household full of people, who had sold hard drugs to people who overdosed on them, was selling, I think, human body parts at one point, was selling euthanasia drugs. And you mentioned that euthanasia is legal in some countries. It's very heavily regulated where it is legal, right? You can't just go to a pharmacy and buy a suicide pill. So why is it that you think Ross Ulbricht has found political support among people like libertarians?
I mean, he has a very strong following. I know his mother, Lynn, is a big advocate for him and has kept, you know, the Free Ross alive. But I think some of more the policymakers and decision makers may not know the full facts of the case. So I appreciate you getting the word out there of some of the facts of the case that is just sort of been perverted over time or sort of lost over the last 10 years.
Because there does seem to be this perception out there that, oh, he just ran a website, you know, and how can he be held responsible for what happened on this website? But I guess you're arguing it was a little bit more than that, and that he was he had knowingly constructed an illicit marketplace and was profiting from it to the tune of millions of dollars.
Well, I don't have to argue that. He was found guilty of that. So, those facts are already been decided by a jury.
Now, look, you seem reticent to express an opinion one way or another about whether or not he should be released. Like, I got to be honest, like, these, and I've spoken with journalists too who covered this, like people who are in the court all the time, people who know the family, and they say the whole thing's really weird because, you know, IRL, like in real life, Ross Ulbricht seems like a perfectly reasonable, nice person who was just a monster when given anonymity. and a keyboard and this sort of virtual empire. So I don't know what an appropriate sentence for him is. It does strike me, though, that 11 years is a little bit light. You know, you can't tell me you have absolutely no feelings about the way this will go. I mean, that's what you said when we started this conversation. I don't believe you, Chris. I mean, what do you think about the idea that he could be out in a couple of months? It must, I mean, isn't it crazy making for you?
Well, you are correct that I do have feelings. I don't publicly make those feelings out there. But you're also right. Ross is a nice guy. I mean, I was with him for, you know, a couple of days. I arrested him one afternoon. We spent that afternoon together through the booking process and that sort of thing. And he, you know, he asked for a lawyer, so I couldn't question him. But we could still talk as human beings. And I bought him breakfast the next morning as I took him out of jail and took him over to court. So, you know, he did seem like a nice person. But remember when I was trying to hunt for him for and find him, I spent 9 months learning who DPR was. And DPR doesn't necessarily mean that's Ross. People flex what I call their e-muscles online. We see it every day. People have a voice on X or Twitter that they would never use in a public setting. They would never say the same things to someone's face. You know, I arrested a guy named Hector Montsegur, who was Sabu in Anonymous. Hector and Sabu, two different people. The online persona is not the person you meet. And so you are right. Ross is a good person and a nice person. But DPR, Ross's persona online, did a lot of horrible things.
So do you think that that is, do you think that that actually mitigates their culpability a little bit? I mean, that's the core question in all of this, right? And that's the thing that I find really funny is like, do we cut people a little bit of slack for the crimes they commit when they think they're shielded by internet anonymity? And I mean, that doesn't seem right.
I don't believe so. I don't believe just because your crimes are online versus inside a bank or inside a store, it's no less of a crime.
All right. Well, Chris Tarbell, thank you so much for joining us to talk about all of this. A fascinating interview. Great to meet you. And we'll talk again, I hope.
Thanks, Pat. Yeah, it was great. Anytime.
That was Chris Tarbell, a former FBI agent there, with a discussion about Ross Ulbricht, or the Dread Pirate Roberts, as he is known. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Feroz Abukadije from Socket. Socket is a software supply chain security company which can basically flag bad packages that you might be bringing into your projects. So if someone's hijacked a package and put a bunch of malware in there, it'll let you know. If a package is trying to do stuff like send, you know, environment information off to some random server in Russia, it'll let you know that. If it's trying to download and run executables, it'll let you know that, right? So just a good idea in this age where we're constructing software out of so many pre-built packages. But Feroz has made a good point, and he's here to make the case that we need to start tracking bad packages the same way that we track CVEs, and that there needs to be some sort of central repository for this information. So here's Feroz Abukadije to make that case.
We're detecting about 100 supply chain attacks per week in NPM, Ruby Gems, Maven, and some of the other popular ecosystems. And the big problem is that when we find these threats, our options are very limited. We can obviously protect our customers. We can give them that data. We can, you know, we have a lot of ways to do that, and we have a lot of folks already using that. But to protect the broader community, our options are contact the registry and let them know that this package is malicious. We get various levels of responsiveness from the different registries. We see that, you know, a lot of these are volunteer run, right? Like PyPI is volunteer run, for instance. And so they're under a lot of load, the folks maintaining these registries. And so there's usually a pretty long period where these packages remain live before they're taken down, if at all. I mean, we're tracking some stuff that's been up for years and is still not taken down and just got lost in the mess. And then the problem is, like, once it is taken down, there's no way for a company to figure out whether or not they ever installed that package in the past. You don't get a CVE issued. NVD and, you know, that whole system is, they very rarely issue a CVE for one of these types of findings. They just consider it out of scope, not to mention the other problems they have around, you know, just the backlog and inability to do what their current, you know, purposes today, right? So it's not a good situation, right? So then the only way for people to find out whether they might have installed one of these packages is to come to a vendor like us, and we can help them look through their Artifactory or whatever they might be using internally to mirror packages, and to see if they're, you know, in some cases still mirroring packages that have already been removed for being malicious in the public registry, but it's still being served to developers inside the company, for instance. So yeah, it's a huge problem.
But do you currently publish this information to your website though, right? Like stuff that you find not just for customers, but I guess what you're arguing is it shouldn't just be up to a private vendor to catalog this stuff.
I think so, yeah. You know, it feels like something, this data feels like it's analogous to what the National Vulnerability Database does, right? The NVD is cataloging vulnerabilities, and we need something analogous for malicious packages. If they don't want to do it, someone needs to do it. We put them on our website today for folks to access. And you know, we're not today publishing them in like a consumable format, but folks go and search for a package, you know, they can get all the information that we have.
Yeah, so you're not like publishing standardized data, like some sort of XML feed that people can ingest and then, you know, throw around. I guess that makes sense because that's kind of valuable IP at that point, right?
That's right, especially because of the time delay, right? I mean, we find stuff within a second or two of it being published, since we're replicating the feed in real time, and we have basically every package and every new version of every package. And so that, you know, that is kind of part of the value add of what we can do for folks is give them that, you know, coverage while they're waiting for the takedown to happen. But we do take it down, right? We do want to make sure that the community is protected and they don't have we're sharing our information with the registries right away when we find stuff. It's just that they're the ones who are taking time to actually get it removed.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's probably worth pointing out at this point that NVD is having trouble. Like you alluded to that earlier, they're having trouble even doing their current workload. There's been new contracts issued and whatever, but I mean, at some point they just stopped enriching vulnerability data earlier this year, right? Like, do you know, have you been tracking that much?
I've been following it somewhat. Yeah, I know that at one point there was more than 50% of vulns on the KEV list, you know, the known exploited vulnerability list, that were missing that enrichment data. So all the valuable details and context that would provide. And so that's just, you know, that backlog and that whole, you know, especially not having stuff even on the KEV isn't even that many vulnerabilities, you know, in the grand scheme of things. So I just think it really undermines the reliability of CVEs as the kind of primary means of assessing software security. And that's something that's always frankly bothered me, is that when folks throw a package into a vuln scanner and say, oh yeah, there's no, you know, there's no CVE, or, you know, it doesn't match, they think it's safe to run that package. But like,
yeah,
you know, it's always been bigger. It's always been a bigger problem than that, right?
Yeah. Now, just speaking of the problem, you said earlier that you track something like, you know, 100 malicious packages every week. Are there any places where they're popping up more than others? Are there particular types of malicious packages that are, you know, more likely to do the rounds at the moment? Like, what's a rough breakdown of what that threat environment looks like?
Hmm. Yeah, there's a bunch of campaigns that we've posted about recently. There was recently a massive malware campaign that was using Ethereum smart contracts to evade detection. They were using that as kind of the command and control. And it was a huge kind of spam campaign. It went and posted a bunch of packages and squatted a bunch of names. There was a recent thing we found too that's quite interesting, something we're kind of calling an author typo squatting attack, where the attackers were able to impersonate a popular maintainer on NPM by faking important metadata in the package that ended up kind of showing up on the official package website. So it's, you know, there's it's always evolving. There's always like new stuff. A lot of it obviously is going to be like really, you know, just in terms of volume, is going to be pretty silly and not the most eye-popping things. You get like a lot of just people just stealing all the environment variables as soon as the package is installed. That type of thing we catch all the time. What mystifies us is just how little effort is put into like even attempting to obfuscate what they're doing, right? I mean, it's like they know no one's looking. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you're the one who's looking, right? Which is why it's mystifying to you, because you could see it. But as you point out, most people don't look, right? So they're not going to see it. You know, you just mentioned, well, most of it's pretty dumb. Most of it's like not eye-popping. There's no obfuscation. What's some of the more advanced stuff that you've seen? Can you talk a little about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've seen stuff that's just like heavily, heavily obfuscated, stuff that targets a single organization through, you know, checking different facts about the environment and only activating in those scenarios. We've
And what sort of organizations are they targeting there? Is that like, I'm guessing crypto exchanges are going to feature pretty heavily there.
Mm-hmm. They often target crypto wallets. So if they can get built into one of those wallets, and you know, a lot of those, you know, tend to be built with Electron, right? So you got a lot of JavaScript dependencies in those wallets. It's like, it's such a target, right? You get into the wallet and you can just wreak havoc and steal the keys. It's such an incentive to go after, right? When you have just all that juicy crypto sitting right there.
Can you think of examples where that's been successful?
Yeah, for sure. There was an incident not too long ago in a package called let's see, which story do I want to tell? Because there's actually been multiple of these. My favorite one, this is the one that actually caused me to start the company, to be honest with you, right? So there was a package called Events Stream. It got about 6 million weekly downloads, a very popular package made by a maintainer who is very prolific. He has published over 500 packages, one of these mega maintainers. Some of the packages not very well maintained, as you can imagine, one person trying to manage that many projects. But one of his projects was very widely depended upon by the ecosystem, was used in, you know, in a lot of almost, you know, all of the dependency trees of a lot of Node.js users. And so someone approached him and said, hey, you're not really maintaining this package. There hasn't been an update in 2 years. Could I have commit rights to be able to help maintain this because we use it at my company? And this maintainer was like, yeah, sure, of course, like whatever. I'm not even using this anymore. I've already moved on and made a replacement for this library that I like better. So he gave the access to the person and even removed himself and fully was like, I'm done. You have the package. And that person proceeded to make good publishes for about a month. And then they took the permission they had and used that to put a obfuscated backdoor into the package. If this is sounding familiar, this is something that happened this year with XE, the XE utils compromise. It's almost the exact same pattern. This happened back in 2017. So you can see how little we've improved as a security community when it comes to these things. The best part of all is, you know, the way that the backdoor triggered is it looked at the context in which it was executing. And if it was running inside the particular, Electron app, it would decrypt the code successfully and then execute it. Otherwise, the decryption would fail. But the way the community caught it was it's going to sound a lot like what happened with XE. You got a nerdy programmer just kind of looking at things. So what happened was the Node.js runtime deprecated a function used by the attacker in their attack code, and
it broke.
It didn't break. Just a warning was printed, but the deprecation happened a couple days after the backdoor was added. And so they didn't know that this was deprecation was going to happen. And so folks that were running the bleeding edge version of the Node runtime were getting this deprecation warning and traced it back to this chunk of obfuscated code. And were like, what the heck is this? It looks super out of place,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound so similar to XE? Like, you know, you got this, you know, total accidental discovery. You know, it makes you realize, like, if we keep finding these things accidentally so often, you know, how much more work is there to do as an industry to improve this?
Now, I just want to go back to the idea of, you know, an NVD-like body doing some tracking here. As much as we do this for CVEs, we've never really done it for malware, right? We've never really had one central repository for malware signatures, hashes, whatever. So, I mean, aren't these supply chain infiltrations a little bit more akin to malware than to CVEs? I mean, I guess it's complicated, isn't it? Because you are talking about a building block of software, and that's often what CVEs are used to... You know, you want to track those issues as you're importing stuff into your code. So it seems like this sort of straddles the line a bit between being, you know, more like a CVE or more like a malware SIG.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a vulnerability that we're talking about here. It is different. But the thing about the CVE system is it's actually one area that we've actually done pretty well as an industry. We've widely deployed CVE scanners and you know, CVE scanners are oftentimes they're in the compliance requirements and, you know, things that we have to cover as security practitioners. So given that we have this system and given that it's already widely deployed, you know, it might be the case that we should just use it for more things, you know, because everyone's already, you know, hooked in some way to this system. So that's the argument for using it for more than just vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good one. All right, Feroz Abukadije, thank you so much for joining us this week to talk through all things software supply chain security. A pleasure to chat to you as always.
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Pat.
That was Feroz Abukadije there from Socket, and you can find them at socket.dev. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back soon with more risky business for you all. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.